From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NPR correspondent David Green spent 2 years based in Moscow covering Russia until just last month. His last assignment, riding the rails of the Trans-Siberian Railway from Moscow all the way to Vladivostok in the North Pacific. That's a long way at a time of high ferment in Russia. Today he's with us. This hour on Point, NPR's David Green on Russia Now, on and off the Trans-Siberian Railway. You can join the conversation. How do you picture the Trans-Siberian? Is it tea and vodka and tundra in your mind's eye? And what about Russia? How do you see Russia today? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last month, it was Trans-Siberian time for David Green. Russians were in uproar. He was on the rails and in towns along the Trans-Siberian.
Geese are wandering around snow-covered dirt streets, honking at the passing trains. The dilapidated wooden houses in the village are heated by wood stoves. The people, tough and gritty.
Tough and gritty. David Green joins us now from Washington, Moscow correspondent for NPR until the end of last month. He's now host and correspondent for NPR's morning programming. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
It's great
I really
to
appreciate
have
the invitation.
Yeah, sure. And welcome home to the USA.
Thank you. It's good to be a little warmer. My wife is very happy to be back. I'm happy to be back. It's taking a little adjusting, but it's good to be home.
We've got very real life and very current politics and big issues to talk about in Russia. But you, in the last month of your time there, were looking at this country, which is in so much ferment lately, through the prism of the Trans-Siberian. And I wish you'd just paint a picture of what that is like for us. Many people dream of doing it one day. No small number of people over the years have somehow, one way or another, done it themselves. You've just done it. Is this a romantic rail trip across Russia? Is it rough and tumble? Is it beautiful? Is it brutal? Give us a sense of this sort of rail passage itself.
I think all of those adjectives are probably apply. I mean, it's an ordeal, and it's a fascinating ordeal. A lot of the time, it's long hours looking out at just the same landscape every single day. There's not a whole lot of daylight because it's wintertime, but when you are able to look out, you're seeing this vast snowy landscape and little villages going by with smoke coming out of chimneys. And so you can sit there for 1 hour and say, God, this scene is just beautiful and majestic, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And then when you get to about hour 49 on a 60-hour leg, you know, you get a little bit of cabin fever, and you're like, what book am I going to turn to next? Is my iPod going to run out of charge? So it's a long, long journey, but overall, it's something I will never forget, and it just really drives home how vast Russia really is. I mean, you know, it's so much bigger than the United States. Siberia alone is larger than our country, and there's no better way to kind of grasp that than to just be on a train for so many hours and so many days.
Paint the simple geography of this route for us. You got on the train in Moscow, and then what's it look like in terms of topography, in terms of your path across that vast land expanse?
Well, Moscow, you know, it's very European, and you go to the train station, and Moscow is this, you know, huge city that has 9 train stations. So it's very busy and very lively, and you're on the train platform with a lot of passengers. Many are elderly women, babushkas, they call them in Russia, and they have, you know, these large sacks of things. It might be things they're trying to sell. It might be their belongings. They're going to visit family, and then you set off, and you know, the first stop we made, Yaroslavl, you know, it's pretty industrial. It's a couple hours east of Moscow, and that feels still sort of European. And then you keep going east from there, and you get into the Ural Mountains, which sound a lot more significant than they appear.
I mean, these are low mountains.
Low mountains, and they're the dividing line between Europe and Asia. So certainly an important border, but you can sleep through them. You don't really. It's not like you're going up. It's not like the Rockies where you're going through these sharp these sharp mountains that you see rising. You can sleep through it, and someone tells you you've crossed the Urals, and then through Siberia, it's just days of flat forest and flat, you know, empty landscape until you reach Lake Baikal. And this is it's similar to Lake Tahoe. I don't know if you've been there.
Yeah,
but,
and you were all the way out here, sort of north of Mongolia. This is around Irkutsk and that whole region.
Irkutsk, and you're getting exactly north of the Mongolian border. Sort mm-hmm. of, it's becoming Asia, but it's a magnificent setting. It's this lake ringed by snow-capped mountains. It's frozen in the wintertime. It's the world's deepest freshwater lake, and it just breaks the monotony. Suddenly, you know, I remember waking up. The sun was just coming up. I opened the curtains in our cabin and looked out and sort of saw through the trees some water, and I was just like, you know, darn it, we're at Lake Baikal, which I was waiting for.
Seven time zones all the way across, and about halfway across, maybe a little more, there's a fork in the Trans-Siberian. There's a northern route that goes to Vanino, and then there's the southern route closer to Mongolia, closer to China, that takes you ultimately to Vladivostok. You took the southern route, David?
We took the route to Vladivostok, but there's actually another route, Tom, that goes down through Mongolia and to China, to Beijing. So mm-hmm. so you really do have some choices to make. You know, a lot of people, when they dream of doing the Trans-Siberian, they think about Moscow to Beijing. But since we really wanted to focus on life, culture, politics, and get a sense for modern Russia, you know, we decided to stick to the full Russia route and head to Vladivostok and pull in there.
Who rides these rails today? And do they go the whole distance, or were you the only one who took the train the whole way and everybody else getting off and on using it as a local?
Were we the only lunatics who never got off in some?
Right.
No, it's really a mix. You know, I spoke to one young 20-something Russian who works at a movie theater in Moscow and got a bonus, knew that he was getting a bonus for Christmas, and this had always been his dream, and we sort of shared a moment since it had always been a dream of mine. Then there are a lot of people who are traveling this way because airfare is too expensive for them. You know, some of the smaller Russian cities to actually get a flight to get to Moscow or to get to another part of the country, just prohibitively expensive for them, and so train travel is the best way to do it, and they load up on food, they're meeting strangers. And it's a much friendlier atmosphere. You know, I get on Amtrak or, you know, a train in the United States and travel from Washington to New York or elsewhere. And, you know, you can meet people, but it's not like that's part of the culture. If you're traveling on the Trans-Siberian, especially because you're sharing, a lot of people are sharing compartments with strangers, you just expect to make friends. And, you know, you'd go into places and I'd interview people and say, gosh, you know, how long have you known each other? And they'd say about an hour and a half. And they seem like best friends already, you know, sharing food and chatting.
David Green is just off the Trans-Siberian Railway and just back to the United States after 2 years in Russia. He joins us today from Washington. David, we've got callers for you already thinking about this fabled rail line in great expanse, seven time zones. Richard in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually took a motorcycle trip from Vladivostok to Europe in 2006. And one thing that I wanted to point out was what I noticed was that there were a lot of towns that had been supported artificially by the communist regime that had just become grindingly poor. And it was very evident when I came into these towns. There was nothing going on. I don't know what the future held for these people, but that was the comment I wanted to make, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Hey, Richard, we'll do that, but let me ask you first. I mean, David Green did this sitting at least on the seat of a train. You did it on a motorcycle, seven time zones and then more. How long did that take you, Richard?
It took me about 6 weeks, and the roads were incredibly bad from Khabarovsk to, Irkutsk.
Were you paralleling the Trans-Siberian Railway some of that time?
It's actually the only road that goes. They both parallel one another. It's mm-hmm. one road, and it goes all the way.
A couple of years later, you could have waved David Green from the road and he to you. It's an amazing thing to just contemplate that motorcycle trip. But, Richard, thank you. David Green, how about it? These grindingly poor towns that have lost their one-time Soviet support in the last couple of decades.
Well, before I get to that, Tom, mm-hmm. I do want to tell you, Richard, that Ian Fraser has written a book, Travels in Siberia.
Yeah.
He talks about that very stretch of road you were talking about, so bad that you couldn't take a car. You actually have to load a car onto the train to make it across it. So you're quite an
adventurer. Or a trail bike.
Yeah, exactly, for making it on motorcycle. No, but Richard, what you saw is what I saw, too. I mean, the poverty in Russia is, you know, it's extraordinary. And in some of the villages, and you played some tape from the village of Sagra mm-hmm. right at the top there, mm-hmm. Tom. I mean, it's you know, houses that don't have plumbing and people who are living in really tough conditions, but are so gritty and so hardy and they survive. But that really is part of the backdrop of, I think, the, you know, the political situation in Russia today that sometimes is forgotten when you see the images of, you know, more middle class Russians who are on the streets of Moscow protesting. A lot of Russia is, as Richard describes, these places that were propped up by the communist government during Soviet times, but are just sort of in many ways disappearing and losing themselves today.
Russia was exploding, at least in Moscow, while you were on this train. Now, we're going to talk about that. But did you see evidence along this great expanse of the Trans-Siberian of the high ferment that was underway in Moscow, the tens of thousands in the streets, or was that like another planet, David?
We saw such a different narrative, but one that I think is connected in certain ways. I mean, as a journalist, I have to say it was tough to be having this huge story in Moscow while I was, you know, thousands of miles away on a train. And there were moments where I was like, God, I better find the closest airport. But things are changing in Russia, and we can talk more about that. But it's just playing out differently in these towns and villages that are far away. These are different people with different interests, different history. It's not the middle class Russians who work in international companies in Moscow. These are people who lead very different lives, but I think are yearning for change, but not in the same way as in the capital.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a 6,000-mile trip across Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railway and how Russia looks now from the Trans-Siberian to Moscow's Red Square with NPR's Moscow correspondent until last month, David Green, just off the Trans-Siberian and back in the USA. Here's David Green starting off on his 6,000-mile journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway. Here he is in Moscow.
This is the spot where most Trans-Siberian journeys begin. I'm standing at Yaroslavsky Rail Station. It's actually one of nine train stations in the city of Moscow. Off to my right, there's a statue of Lenin staring out onto the street. And to my left, all the trains are lined up and people waiting to board. And this spot, this place, has meant so many different things over time.
Soldiers traveling the Trans-Siberian, political prisoners traveling the Trans-Siberian to sad ends in the gulag. David Green joins us from Washington. And David, we've got a lot of response here already online. Robert says, 10,000 kilometers of ice, wolves, gulags, oppression, and hungry bears. I pass. You can have it, David Green. But
it's Holly, not for everyone.
You know, Holly writes, I traveled the Trans-Siberian in 1986. So we're back in Soviet time there. She writes, what a trip. The scenery, changing trains, and the gauge, the width of the rail. I had gave one very nice female conductor an Elle magazine I'd bought in London and read to death. She, the Russian, clasped it to her chest like it was the best gift ever. She gave me a little decorative patch that day. I still have it and think about her. And here's from Wilson. He writes, being a rail enthusiast, I would love to take this journey. However, I've been a bit skeptical of the safety on the journey. Could you please talk about the safety hazards or precautions one should observe on the Trans-Siberian? I don't know, David, how about it? Safety on this long railway?
You know, it felt pretty safe, and we were getting off at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning for a breath of fresh air on some of the train platforms, and we certainly, you know, sort of looked around and made sure we were careful, and we locked our, you know, we locked our compartments when we went down to the dining car. So safety wasn't really a concern. It was a fascinating, colorful sort of population on the train. You know, you met people who would bring you into their compartments late at night and offer you vodka or rum or cognac, and that might be the safety factor that I'd be careful about because, you know, too much of that and you might have trouble waking up and working the next day. And one of the funnier moments, there was a woman who was selling cabbage rolls, walking from door to door, and she came in and noticed that we didn't speak the language, and she really took us for a ride. She convinced us that we should pay her something like 800 rubles for her entire stock of cabbage rolls.
Ooh and, la la, must
you know,
have.
She was like, just trust me. And I said, no, you know, I should go get my translator. She was like, no, you don't need a translator. Trust me. And it turned out this was sort of a day-old batch with no cabbage inside. And so we bought basically a pile of bread for $25. But, you know, in terms of real safety,
it comes with the territory.
It comes with the territory.
How do you feed yourself on this? I mean, is there a dining car where you just retreat and eat? Or are you talking about, you know, fellow passengers with Belarusian sausages and all the rest? What's the way?
there is a dining car, and it is very much like a lot of restaurants in Russia. You have to get used to it. The menu is just sort of a suggestion, and when you actually start ordering from it, 9 times out of 10, they'll say, "We don't have that today. We don't have that today. We don't have that today. We do have borscht," and so you might, you know, have some soup, and so you know, it's the dining car is an experience. There's usually some sort of weird dance music playing, so it's worth a stop. But a lot of passengers will share food, and you know, that's when I tasted the Belarusian sausage. Mm. That's when you really get a feel for the food of Russia. And then, very important, Tom, is the boiler, which is this sort of vat of hot water that's at the end of every car, and it like keeps you alive because you visit it like 20, 30 times a day. You go there to make
coffee. The teapot, in effect. The samovar.
The samovar, but it's a sort of a modern samovar. Yeah, a lot of Russians get mad at you if you call it a samovar because it runs on electricity. Yeah, exactly. But you make soup. You make instant soup there. You make oatmeal in the morning. You make tea. You make coffee. I mean, if that thing shut down, you'd want to jump off the train and just say, there's no chance.
Soup, tea, coffee, and borscht on the menu today. And of course, a lot going on in Russia as this happened, and a lot of it very difficult and very unresolved. We'll look at that, but a couple of callers first. Earl in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Earl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Fun topic. My wife and I took the Trans-Siberian Railroad at the height of the Cold War in 1969.
Oh, wow.
We were coming back from Vietnam. We were conscientious objectors, had worked 3 years in Vietnam, and discovered it was the cheapest way home. So took a ship from Japan to Nordhodka, and then up to Khabarovsk, which was our most delightful time. We met some students in a university in Khabarovsk, and they asked us all about Vietnam, and then we asked them about the Soviet invasion into Czechoslovakia.
So we're in the Wayback Machine. What do you think now, Earl, as you look out at everything happening in Russia against that now distant Soviet history there?
Oh, I would love to go back and meet those students. Those students in that university for the next 5 years would send us a Christmas card every year, which was true delight right there in the middle of the Cold War. It was an assurance to us that people are people everywhere. We haven't been back to the Soviet Union since that time, but we sure had a good time then.
Long ago, and so many changes since then on so many facets of Russia and the world. David Green, what about traveling as an American in Russia today on those same rails? Did you feel, I don't know, were people suspicious? Were they welcoming? Did they want to know what you had to say or not?
Very, very welcoming. And it's, Moscow is a place that's sort of become used to international visitors and diplomats and expats living there. But once you get out into the country, you know, you're still, you know, as an American, kind of welcome. People, you know, look at you curiously and have a lot of questions about the country. And Earl, I would be fascinated to sit down with you sometime and hear about your travels, you know, some decades ago. That's incredible. And Khabarovsk, I will tell you, I stopped there. There's still a university, a lot of educated younger people, which made me wonder whether there was going to be a sense of connection, you know, to the anti-government protests back in Moscow. And they did have a much smaller protest of a few hundred people, mostly students who are getting angry about the current political situation. But you know, cities like Khabarovsk, despite being educated college towns, have not risen up, you know, in a big way yet. But what a great stop that was. Khabarovsk, I believe, as Earl might remember too, is the coldest city in the world with a population of over 500,000 people. I think that's Khabarovsk's claim to fame.
They managed,
and I can attest to that.
Right. We want to go to those political sentiments, but we've still got callers just on getting around. Leora in Lexington, Massachusetts. You're on the air with David Green.
Hi, Tom and David.
Hi. Hi.
David, you're my favorite NPR correspondent, so I'm really happy.
That is
that's
very kind of you to say. That means a lot. Thank you.
And the reason is because I think that you're really eloquent. You paint a picture of where you are with both insight and compassion, and it's so moving. So I really appreciate your reporting from Russia, also because I have a personal connection. My father was born in Baranovichi, which is now in Belarus, but it was Russia, Poland, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there in 1992, and also went and met a first cousin of his in Moscow who he has never met, whose father was a general in the Red Army, fought against Franco, and when he came back was executed by Stalin. But anyway, this cousin was an engineer in Siberia, and I guess as a reward or something, he got this car, quote unquote, called a Lada, I think.
Sure, yeah, Russian Lada.
Yep.
Yeah, and he could not drive for anything, and his son had to like crank something, and then jump into the car, and then off we would go, half on the sidewalk, half in the street. it was quite an experience. But when I was there, the grocery stores were empty. I mean, literally, like there was nothing.
Yeah, Leora. Of course, there were years like that. I've seen it in Russia. I'm sure David Green, maybe out in the boonies, you saw it as well. I appreciate your call, Leora. I want to turn with you, David, if I may, to a bit more of the political perspective here, because you know, the rails have been there, and the romance of the rails, and the romance of interaction with what was forbidden territory, Russia, less forbidden today, but sometimes quite forbidding. And you paid close attention to its 20 post-Soviet years and the kind of where things stand now. They may have been in the streets in Moscow, but you found something a little more timeless and not quite so heady across much of the country. Here's a little snapshot, a little more of you from riding the rails across the Trans-Siberian.
In the Russian towns and villages I visited, I had to forget all assumptions about democracy. For years, people have lived under this set of unspoken rules. Life will be hard, the government will provide few services, and people in power might be corrupt. But there's nothing you can do about it.
David Green, on the rails there in Russia. I remember hearing that when your series played on the air, and it was hard for me from a great distance to put that up against the scenes in Moscow of tens of thousands of people in the street who clearly felt that there was something that they were going to try and do about the current politics, the Putin politics, the next run for the presidency and all the rest. Help us understand this tension, dichotomy between these two pictures. Very active people in their thousands, in the streets, and this sort of timeless, there's nothing you can do about it sense.
Well, and I think the nothing you can do about it, that's been the feeling for a long time. And I what I saw, obviously, in Moscow, as we've seen the protests, but getting out into the country, you know, that is beginning. It's beginning to change the assumptions that people had, and that was one of the themes that we focused on was how much Russians have endured over time. I mean, tragedies and, you know, tough leaders. I think it's really an adjustment for them to start questioning, you know, are we being repressed, because they're so used to it, and they feel like, you know, being, you know, enduring tough leaders is what makes them strong. It's just a different type of culture and a different way to learn about yourself. And that's one backdrop. And also there's really a fear of the word and the idea of democracy. You know, during the Yeltsin years and after the Soviet collapse, I mean, Russia went into an economic abyss, and people still fear, you know, something, anything resembling a democratic movement. And so in Moscow, when people, you know, are much more up on what's going on around the world they're more educated, middle class, they have jobs, they have a lot of dealings with people in other countries, you know, they see the idea of going on the streets as something potentially really productive. When you get out into the rest of the country, it's not that people don't want change. And I visited this village, Sagra, where people had this run-in with this criminal gang. The villagers called the police. They begged for help. The police never showed up. And then the local government came along and was going to charge the residents of this village with hooliganism, basically blaming them for this battle they had with this criminal gang. And in the past, you know, I think a lot of Russians might have said, okay, this is what our government's decided to do. We have to deal with it. Because now a lot of these villagers, as poor as they are, you know, have access to the internet. You know, they started saying, we can get our message out. We can let our voice be heard. And so it's these small changes that are happening in communities like that that make you realize that Russia is at a defining moment, but not necessarily in the way that it is in Moscow. You know, I talked to those villagers and they said, you know, yeah, we have a voice. We're starting to sort of test the waters. We've become an annoyance to our local government, as one gentleman put it to me. But in the same breath, they also said, but God, what's happening in Libya scares me to death. You know, the people who live in Libya are going to go through harder times now economically, and we don't want that. We don't want a big overthrow. And so they're really doing a lot of soul searching. And I think the storyline is just very, very different across much of Russia, but not unrelated to the events in Moscow.
Hard to put the two pieces together from a distance sometimes. You know, the famous blogger there, Alexei Navalny.
Navalny, yeah.
Here he was blogging in those days. He was put in jail. He was so influential in getting people out in the streets. There's more to come on that front. Another big protest scheduled there. Here's one of his blogs. Everyone has the single most powerful weapon that we need, dignity, the feeling of self-respect. It's impossible to beat and arrest hundreds of thousands, millions. We have not even been intimidated. And he wrote, for some time, we were simply convinced that the life of mute cattle was the only way to win the reward of stability and economic growth. Then he wrote, we are not cattle or slaves. We have voices and votes, and we have the power to uphold them. Now, here we are back in the States reading that. And meanwhile, we're hearing this. This is a little tape again from your trip. This is Ella Stroganova, curator of a little museum in the city of Yaroslavl, not so far east of Moscow, telling you, David Green, that the comparatively easier lives of the current generations of Russians might be causing them to lose some of their national identity, national strength. And listen to her on progress here.
My personal opinion is that progress makes person absolutely weak. He loses his strength because he doesn't need to think how to survive.
Alexei Navalny, all about progress and dignity in the individual, and then progress makes a person absolutely weak. Help us understand this, David.
It's very difficult, and I think that's the lack of connection that I saw in terms of people out in the country, you know, and what's happening in Moscow. You know, the days that the Moscow protests were happening, there were stories, you know, there were a lot of protests in cities and towns across Russia. And we should say, Tom, any protest in a Russian city is significant. You know, if you see 100 people, it's a development. But that said, these were much, much smaller events. They weren't attracting the large numbers of people. And, you know, it's people want change. They want something different. They just, you know, it's happening much more slowly. And you listen to a person like Ella, who you just played, and, you know, she's not going to hit the streets. She's not going to be out there fighting for democracy. You know, it's a much more complicated and nuanced process. And Russians just, you know, they feel like their history is different. They feel like they're going to sort of come up with their path differently than other places in the world. And they're going to define it for themselves.
You spent 2 years in Moscow, in Russia, and a couple of weeks on the Trans-Siberian. Do you think your sense of the country would be different if during those 2 weeks of uprising, you'd been back in Red Square instead of in Khabarovsk?
Very possible. And that was, you know, and I did get to, I got back to Moscow in time for the second large protest when there were thousands of people again. It is an amazing and emotional scene to see people on the streets of Moscow, you know, calling for change. And so to be able to kind of compare and contrast that to what I saw out on the railroad was, you know, I felt lucky to be able to see both. And what's happening in Moscow, it's a defining moment. What's going to be interesting, I think, is to see how Vladimir Putin responds to these calls for change in Moscow. So far, he's taken sort of a hard line, but we'll see where he goes from there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a 6,000-mile trip across Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railway and how Russia looks now from the Trans-Siberian to Moscow's Red Square with NPR's Moscow correspondent until last month, David Green. He joins us today from Washington, back in the USA. 7 time zones of that trip and a lot along the way. Here he is ending his voyage in Vladivostok, Russia's port city on the Sea of Japan.
We headed eastward. I was on to my final destination, the port city of Vladivostok. And when I got there, I was truly in Asia. Japan, China, North Korea are all neighbors. What you're hearing here is karaoke at the Pyongyang Cafe.
A long way from Moscow right there. At the end of the Trans-Siberian, David Green is with us, and you can join us lots of people who have been there, done at least a piece of that. Josh writes, he rode the rails from Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, to Russia and on to Warsaw. This was back in 93. Rolling bazaar of train cabins full of Mongols selling stuff, Russians scuffling over what was ever for sale. More tea, more vodka, more sausage, green pint bottles of cheap beer, more haggling and scuffling and tedium and flatness, and the steady, never-ending clickety-clack of the wheels. It was a great ride. Though plenty of tedium along the way. Let's get a call right here. Alexander in Niagara Falls, Canada. Alexander, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It is quite nice to stay in the United States or in Canada and talk about Russia, but life is there extremely hard and tough because of the one reason. People are disunited there. When we see the active people on the streets, all people are paid for that. All people are organized for the demonstration to show some their activity. But
can we stop right there? Who's paying them to be on the streets, as you assert, Alexander? Who would you imagine would?
Okay, it's government and people who the top of the pyramid in Russia.
But they're protesting against the top of the pyramid, right? They're protesting against Putin.
Yes, that artificial movement made the top want to change. The top want to change the system, make it more strict. That is why they made artificial movement there. Activity of people. So,
Alexander, are you optimistic about Russia's future, or do you think things will get better there?
Not optimistic at all. There is no freedom at all. People have nothing to eat there. People think, what my kids are going to eat tomorrow. That's all.
Alexander, thanks for your call. You keep us from getting too romantic on the rails here. David Green, first, just about how tough life can be in Russia. You saw it, you know, all the way across here. And then you hear Alexander's pretty jaundiced view of the protests in Moscow. What do you say to that?
I'll say a couple things. In Moscow, I mean, the protest I went to and our colleagues, you know, did not get the sense that people out there were being paid. I mean, they were out there because they wanted change and they wanted to let their voices be heard. I think the point that Alexander made about disunited is really an important one, because when I got out there to Vladivostok, you know, seven time zones away from Russia, there's a place where a few years ago they were able to get people on the streets when it was a real local issue that mobilized people, and that was new tariffs on imported cars from Japan, and people were furious about these tariffs. They took to the streets, they were screaming. So people feel that right, but now, you know, you haven't seen these large protests in Vladivostok, you know, against the government like in Moscow, and there is a sense of disconnection. And when the farther east I got, you know, people would say, during Soviet times, we felt there was this ideology that kept us all together. We felt a connection to Soviet leaders, you know, as hard as life was. Now there's very little connection, sense of identity with Moscow, which has, you know, it's led some analysts to say that as, you know, as things go forward, if Putin is going to go, it's not going to be one big loud revolution on the streets. It's going to be sort of a collapse of the system that's in place and sort of some new system of government, whether it's similar to the United States with sort of different independent states around Russia. So something different will have to take over, because the current system is not sustainable.
What about, I don't know, geographic unity? Vladivostok's a long way from Moscow. It's out in the realm of very dynamic Asian economies. What about the interplay between, let's say, China today and Russia, the sort of economic power of the East versus the perspective from Moscow? Did you feel tension there?
You know, in Moscow, you feel a sense of fear of a place like China. I think there's always been this discomfort between Moscow and Beijing. And you know, at a time when China is really on the rise, you would think that Moscow would be looking for ways to really partner. But there's a sense of hesitation. Once you get out to places like Khabarovsk and Vladivostok, you talk to scholars and others who say this is such an exciting time. China is becoming so powerful. Russia has had trouble, you know, keeping population up. We need to you know, to open the border. We need to bring in Chinese students. We need to be making deals with China and helping our economy. But there's a feeling that Moscow is holding them back. So, I mean, that's just one example in the sort of modern day of why people out in the East feel that this system of government that Moscow's and Vladimir Putin's trying to hold on to just won't work for them in this new day.
Joey in Boston, you're on the air with David Green. Joey, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a few points and then take your comments. I was on the Trans-Siberian in 2004 for 2 weeks and loved it. One of the great pleasures was looking out the train window and seeing the beautiful white birch trees, and it's just gorgeous. I did want to say that while I enjoyed my trip, one of the disappointments I had was you don't really get a sense of the vastness that's beyond. I felt like right along the tracks, it is relatively populated, and you just don't get a sense that there are Texas-sized chunks of land out there.
All over, yeah.
Yeah, you know, squirrels and foxes. Also, I think the dichotomy between the political activism such as it is in, say, Moscow and out in Siberia can be explained largely by geography. They don't have, unfortunately, a tradition in Moscow that we have in America. For example, they didn't have a bonus army where we had people marching across the country. They didn't have a march on Washington or a million-man march. Mm-hmm. It's just not physically and logistically possible in Russia. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. And then the last thing is, I think much of your excellent program has focused on political activism in Moscow, and that's certainly needed. I think we also need political activism in the East, for example, to protect the environment, especially now that gas and oil exploration is shifting to the East. Also for medical care, which I think drastically needs to be improved in Siberia, and also for the native peoples. For much of Siberian history, it's been a history of exploitation, whether it's taking furs out or exploiting natural minerals or exploiting the local people. And I think we also need political activism on their behalf. And,
Joy, let us pick those up right there. That's a lot, and I appreciate your call. Maybe first to the environmental picture. I don't know how much you could perceive from, you know, from the rails as you went, David. But, of course, we've heard over the years about some pretty bad devastation. On the other hand, it's huge country. I don't know how much damage there really is in the context of the whole.
Yeah, you know what? One of the interesting things that when Joey mentions political activism when it comes to the environment, Lake Baikal, which is just a treasure environmentally, there's a paper mill, an old Soviet era paper mill that Vladimir Putin approved the reopening of, and there were thousands of people, I believe, in the streets of Irkutsk, which is nearby Lake Baikal, protesting that because of the damage it could do to the environment, and you know there's another example of, you know, Russians will get out there on the streets when they feel like it's a cause that moves them. So it's not that people won't get politically active. You know, I think that the question is the movement right now, the anti-Putin movement, going to be able to capture the imagination of people around the country and get them on the streets?
I mean, it's kind of ironic. You know, Joey says they don't have the tradition that we have of the bonus army, World War One vets marching on Washington or the Million Men March, to say that of Russia, where, on the other hand, they have like the 20th century story of revolution taking over an enormous country. I mean, they do have that tradition at the same time of the country
rising up. And it scares
them.
The idea of revolution scares people right now. And I think that's one of the struggles that a lot of Russians are having. It's like I don't – they're saying to themselves, you know, maybe Putin is not the leader I want, but revolution is something that really frightens me. So how do I bring change in my community and in my country without having a so-called revolution? And you know, it's a near impossible question to answer for many people.
And you've said there's even – and for Americans, this may be odd to hear, but on the other hand, we've watched Russia twist and turn in the post-Soviet era, but a fear of the very word democracy.
Fear of democracy, I think even more fear of revolution. And I think that you know, Putin brought a sense of stability for a long time, and that is beginning to change in the minds of a lot of Russians, but then they haven't answered that next question. So what do I want? And then on the other side, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who are really disappointed so far with the alternatives. They, you know, they said when the March presidential election comes, you know, they would tell me, I really don't want to vote for Putin, but the opposition hasn't offered anyone inspiring yet. You know, you could say that's because the opposition hasn't been able to offer anyone. You could also say it's because Putin has been able to keep a lot of political parties in Russia from registering. You know, you could look at it in different ways. But the reality is that a lot of Russians haven't heard a voice yet that has moved them.
Fear of democracy or of instability in some quarters, and in other quarters, people right out on the streets and really asking for it. Elke in Glover, Vermont. Elke, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just put in a blast from the past because I, as a five-year-old child, I traveled with my parents across on the Trans-Siberian Railroad for 2 weeks from Moscow, where my family had lived, to Vladivostok. And my memories of that trip, I was, are of vast forests, the clickety-clack of the train, and then stopping in sometimes very small towns and villages, and on the platform would be huddled very gray and desperate-looking people selling whatever they had. This was in the month of June.
What year, Elke? What year?
1941.
Oh, my. Wow.
Just before the fascist invasion, the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. My father was an American, and he was expelled from the country, and my mother got her visa at the last moment. My mother was Russian, and we were able to have a lawn sale in our apartment of all our worldly goods to buy the tickets for this train ride and made it to Vladivostok.
So were you in effect fleeing from the Nazi invasion from the West?
No, we weren't fleeing from the Nazis. They had not attacked yet,
but we
had to get out of the country, and the only way was eastward, not westward. There was too much. There was already the invasion of Poland and everything there in that direction.
So Elke, if I may, our time is short, but you have such a long perspective since that time. I don't know how closely you've paid attention since then, but here we are, you know, 61 years later, nearly. What's your sense of Russia's path? What's your optimism or pessimism about this country's path?
Well, my relatives, my mother's family, are this sort of silent majority of Russians who just soldier on, who take the good and the bad, and are pretty cynical about their politicians. They don't seem to pay them much mind, but they do want stability, and they certainly appreciate that they have that and their livelihoods.
That may work a little bit for Vladimir Putin right there. Let me get one more, if I may. Elke, thank you so much for that long time scope. Mark in Harvard, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a little more recent aspect. I was working over there for a year and a half, around 2004, 2005. I spent a few months in Moscow, and then I was out east of Chelyabinsk.
What were you doing, Mark?
We were doing chemical demilitarization project.
Demilitarizing chemical weaponry there.
Exactly.
Okay.
We were based in a small village, and I actually spent a lot of time traveling on the train back to Chelyabinsk with the Ekaterinburg and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Got some very, you know, good viewpoints of local economy, that sort of thing. Talked with a lot of locals. Your speaker's hitting the nail on the head. When the Soviet Union collapsed, they had such a depression that we can't even imagine. It doesn't compare to what we're going through.
Economic depression.
Mm-hmm. Economic depression. Mm-hmm. Everything closed. Stores, theaters, restaurants, everything closed. They had nothing left. It's only now where in the biggest cities, they're getting back to where they were when the Soviet Union collapsed. So, you know, they had people that were friends that called them the hungry years. But it is coming back. The countryside is still, it's, you know, people say it's fast. It's unbelievably fast. And it's, we noticed a lack of game deer, that sort of thing, because we were out in the countryside.
Even that gone. Hey, Mark, let me pick it up right there because our time is so short and we've only got David Green another couple of minutes, but I'm really glad for that sort of firsthand account. I don't know, David, I guess where does it all leave you thinking first about Putin? Do you think he'll come back in and be the guy again? And if he does that mean there's a lid on this ferment? That, you know, another, I don't know, whatever, is it 6-8 years and forget about it? Or is something pushing up here that's real change? Or are you into the timeless Russia theme now, David?
Well, you know, a lot of Russians, even who don't like Putin, just expect him to win this March election somehow, either because they expect the government to finagle it and for the election not to be fair, or because they feel like there's just the opposition is not cohesive enough. They haven't come together. And then I think if that happens, he could serve two more terms, which is an extraordinary period of time. And I think it'll
be interesting. 8-year terms or 4-year?
Six-year terms.
Six or 12 more years.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And you know, how he evolves as a politician, there's some who say he has to evolve, you know, in this new modern day. There are others who say that he won't. And some analysts believe he'll make it seem like it's more of an open democracy, you know, while quietly passing laws that sort of continue to crack down on unregistered parties and the opposition. So, you know, it'll be interesting to watch, but a lot of Russians just sort of expect him to be coming back for a long period of time.
And the Trans-Siberian, do you still feel the clickety-clack when you shut your eyes, David?
I do. It's in my dreams, and I'm happy about that. It was a good sound.
7 time zones, 6,000 miles. David Green, after 2 years as a correspondent for NPR in Moscow, and all those miles and time zones across Russia on the Trans-Siberian, it's great to hear it firsthand from you. We'll think of your perspective as we hear you on the air. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a real pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.